Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. After 9,000 years and decades of struggle, the bones of Kennewick men will be returned home for burial. Northwest News correspondent Anna King has the story. We asked philosopher Seth Titchener to share his thoughts on the new year. We'll hear from Seth in the second half of the show. This is The Bridge for the week of December 29th. We begin with a final nod to the holidays and something to consider for your gift list next year. People feel more grateful for what they've done than for what they have, according to new research, and that feeling of gratitude also leads to more generous behavior. Thomas Gilovich is a co-author of the Cornell University report. He explains people make positive comments about the stuff they bought or received, but they don't express gratitude as often as they do for experiences, such as concerts, dance lessons, or dining out at a good restaurant.
So if you want to give a gift that really makes someone happy, there's a lot of things to choose from. But again, think twice about maybe doing an experiential gift over a material one. It might pay off even more.
He adds the feeling of gratitude has been linked to increased happiness and social cohesion, better health outcomes, and even improved sleep quality. Researchers studied 1,200 online customer reviews and found the vast majority of people who used the word grateful purchased experiences, not material items such as electronics, furniture, or clothing. The study suggests experiences tend to help people appreciate their own situations and trigger fewer social comparisons. Gilovich says the urge to keep up with the Joneses if a neighbor buys a better car or a computer than yours can be hard to resist.
We do that with experiences, too. If you went on some sensational vacation, I wonder a bit about mine. But I wonder less than I do for material things.
The study found that gifts of experience also create a positive ripple effect. In the study involving an economic game, players thinking about a meaningful experience were more generous toward others than when they thought about material purchases. A nativity scene that appeared without fanfare at the Washington State Capitol over the Christmas holidays drew protest. An atheist agnostic group installed a counter display on the public Capitol grounds. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has the report from Olympia.
A group that favors separation of church and state installed a portable banner about 20 feet away from the privately sponsored nativity display. In big letters, the sign reads, "Let reason prevail." It ends with a dig, "Religion is but myth and superstition that hardens hearts and enslaves minds." Daryl Barker of the Freedom From Religion Foundation explained the sign.
And any time we see an encroachment of religion into our secular government, at that point, then we speak up.
The longtime sponsor of the Capitol Nativity display took the counter-protest in stride. Ron Wasilius of Tumwater says he doesn't like it, but acknowledges the critics have the same rights he does for a display. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
In 2009, state officials kicked the holiday displays out of the landmark domed Capitol building onto the expansive lawn around the Tivoli Fountain on the publicly owned Capitol campus. That came in the wake of a major brouhaha in 2008, which started when Fox News personality Bill O'Reilly used his show to criticize the state for allowing a mockery of religious symbols. Subsequently, Washington received an application from the Kansas-based Westboro Baptist Church for a "Santa Claus will take you to hell" sign. A parody group proposed a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster holiday display alongside more serious requests for representation by Buddhist and Jewish groups. A temporary moratorium on permit processing put the kibosh on all holiday displays. The holiday season isn't quite over, so what do you do between Christmas and New Year's? Whale watching, says Oregon Parks and Recreation officials. Luke Parsons is a ranger with the Depot Bay Whale Watching Center. He says December 27th through the 31st is whale watching week.
During the winter, we are pretty lucky. We get to watch about 20,000 gray whales as they migrate right past the Oregon coast on their way to Mexico. These whales are headed south to breed or to give birth to their young. This time of year, the animals are traveling between 3 and 5 miles off of shore, so a good pair of binoculars is a good thing to have with you.
Trained volunteers will be at 24 different sites along the Oregon coast, sharing information on the gray whales. And sometimes orcas and humpbacks are spotted. Researchers at Oregon State University have developed a new kind of tag to gather information on whale behavior. Christian Fodenwenzel has more.
Up to now, satellite tags have allowed researchers to track whales thousands of miles, but location was just about the only information they could provide. The new tags, unveiled in the journal Ecology and Evolution this month, provide much more detail. For example, Professor Bruce Mate says they show sperm whales diving all the way to the seafloor, almost a mile deep, and being submerged for 1.25 hours.
Actually has three-axis accelerometers on it so that you can tell as the animal swims along when it makes a lunge forward to grab a squid. You know, is it going up to the left or down to the right? And you can actually tell how many times it attempts to feed on things during each dive.
That sheds light on how much energy a whale spends looking for food and which fishing areas are most productive. The next generation of tags is already being designed. It should be able to download information remotely, so researchers don't have to travel around to find it. I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
It was the rainiest fall on record in parts of eastern Oregon and Washington, which was good for keeping late-season wildfires at bay, but torrential rains wreaked havoc on some timber harvesters in the Northwest. Correspondent Emily Schwing has more.
Employees at Vaughan Brothers Lumber Incorporated in Colville, Washington, got lucky this fall.
We didn't miss a day because of the wet weather.
Josh Anderson is the sawmill's timber manager. It's one of two mills owned by Vaughan Brothers in Pendere County. We climb halfway up the ladder of a giant port crane. It used to move shipping containers. Now it moves tree-sized timber back and forth between sorted piles of logs and the mill itself. Anderson points to a tower of stockpiled logs from a wildfire salvage nearby.
How normal is it to have that much inventory so that, you know, you kind of get past a wet season?
Abnormal for a fall wet season. We build up inventory for fire season, and we build up inventory to get through winter and spring breakup, but not through a fall breakup.
Instead of things freezing up when they were supposed to this fall, the weather stayed warm and wet, similar to the kind of weather expected when winter gives way to spring. That stockpile of timber Anderson points to kept the mill running after roughly 6 inches of rain soaked much of eastern Washington for most of October and into November. But no such stockpile exists for the guys who cut and deliver logs for companies like Vaughan Brothers, so Anderson says they weren't nearly as lucky.
It impacted our loggers and truckers a lot. So they bore the biggest part of the brunt, and it's hard for them to make that up.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Jim Geisinger is the executive vice president of Oregon's Associated Loggers.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a lost opportunity because, you know, when the weather does clear up, you're off to your next job, or maybe you're going back to finish up the one you got ran off of.
Geisinger says fall rain in Oregon likely cut industry-wide production there in half.
The storms just kept coming. And so I would say the impact to our industry was greater than it's ever been.
But he isn't sure how that loss translates into lost dollars or board feet. Those aren't numbers Washington's Forest Protection Association keeps track of either.
You know, when I say we lost 50% of the production, I think you can assume that that percentage ripples through the entire supply chain in our industry.
For now, the rain has stopped, and early in December, warmer than normal weather gave way to frigid temperatures that some parts of the region haven't seen since 2014. Geisinger says cold combined with recent snowfall could be good for loggers in both eastern Oregon and Washington.
Over on the east side, loggers actually like to have a few feet of snow on the ground and to have the ground frozen to do their logging.
It's easier for logging trucks to transport heavy logs on frozen roads, and frozen ground limits problems caused by erosion. On the flip side, though, single-digit temperatures are tough on the many blades and moving parts back at the sawmill. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
We expect wintertime to be rainy in the Pacific Northwest. While the region may need to get used to more intense and heavier rainfalls in the future, this is correspondent John Ryan.
Climate change will bring rain in more intense bursts across most of the country. That's according to a new study from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. The extreme rainfall would come in the summer in much of the country. Here, we'd get it mostly in the winter. The storms known as a Pineapple Express would carry more moisture our way from the tropical Pacific. Lead author Andy Prine says the Northwest can expect the wettest storms to arrive four times more frequently.
The Pacific Northwest is really in a hot spot. You have much higher frequency increases than in the rest of the country, at least in wintertime.
Wintertime is when heavy rains help turn hillsides into mudslides. Extreme downpours can also cause pollution by overwhelming sewage systems. Stormwater runoff is one of the biggest sources of pollution into Puget Sound. But toxicologist John Stark with Washington State University says the amount of rain matters less than the amount of motor oil and other gunk left on the pavement.
Increasing rainfall might not have as big of an effect as an increase in the number of people moving into the area and driving more vehicles, because it's really the volume of traffic.
Reducing that volume of traffic would cut down on the gunk going into Puget Sound and the carbon dioxide going up in the sky. Scientists say it will take deep cuts in the world's carbon dioxide emissions to avoid the worst impacts of a changing climate. The study appears in the journal Nature Climate Change. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
I've got to go away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you'd drop in.
Every night.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like ice.
You're listening to The Bridge. Soon the 9,000-year-old remains of Kennewick Man will be handed over to Northwest tribes. Kennewick Man is an ancient skeleton found along the banks of the Columbia River by students in 1996. The discovery caused a legal battle between the tribes and scientists. On December 16th, President Obama signed a law returning K-Man to the tribes. Correspondent Anna King visited with tribal members in Salalo, that's in north-central Oregon, for her series, Back to Earth.
I came here for a powwow. Dancers with bells strapped to their legs are everywhere. Singers cry out. YM means echo against the rocks. People have continuously lived here at this spot, Salalo Village, for thousands of years. So Rob Begay says, a scientist can't tell him much about a story he already knows about Kennewick Man and his own people.
Maybe they read too many books or something, or, you know, because all those things about the Native Americans, of how supposedly we were, are really not true. A lot of those are just their own theories of, you know, why they think we're from somewhere else. But as me, my parents, my grandparents, and down to generations back, thousands upon thousands of years, that was our oral traditions, stories that we were created here from time immemorial.
Begay says it's important to respect the earth. In the origin stories, that's where his people come from. In fact, he points to a long strip of exposed earth in the center of this longhouse.
This floor, Tichum, Mother Earth, that's where we come from. This is our altar here. To us, this is an altar. That's why it's right here. That's why we stand on both sides of it.
It's important for Begay and others here to see Kennewick Man or the Ancient One return to that sacred earth. A language leader for the Plateau tribes, Thomas Morning Owl, says sometimes people like to think of the tribes as something that happened in the past, disconnected from Kennewick Man so long ago.
Our traditions are alive. Our culture isn't relegated to the past and frozen in time. We are a vibrant community. Our culture is more than Uggs and Shrugs or stones and bones. We live our culture on a daily basis.
Seeing Kennewick Man returned will be good. It's been 20 long years, he says.
We've up to now have been pushed aside as fundamentalist crackpots in the native way that our religion and our practices are of no consequence to anything in science. But then we as a people know what we are charged with.
Morning Owl says each new generation has that same great responsibility to make sure their ancestors are taken care of, honored, and are at rest in the earth. I'm Anna King in Celilo, Oregon.
The tribes call Kennewick Man the Ancient One. Armand Minthorn has been one of the most visible Northwest Native Americans fighting to rebury those ancient bones. Anna King sat down with the Umatilla Reservation tribal councilman and spiritual leader. He's been fighting a 2-decades-long battle for the bones.
Armand Minthorn says it's taboo to bury Native American dead at night because they could make mourners sick. So Minthorn says the Ancient One will be buried by hundreds of tribal elders in the morning.
Because nighttime is when there are unsettled spirits, and that's when they move, is at night. And if they hear somebody crying or hurting, they're going to come and want to see.
Settling the Ancient One's spirit is why many tribal people have fought to see his bones are buried. Over this 20-year fight, Minthorn says he and others have had to wade through 20 years of misunderstandings, ignorance, and pure racism, even from universities and scientists.
It was those radical people that told us that we had no right and that our religion was fake, and that we were no different than Indians on TV.
Minthorn has fought against science for so long. He agrees it's ironic that science has now returned Kennewick Man back to the tribes. The scientists who legally won the right to study Kennewick Man after a 10-year legal battle said the skeleton wasn't from Southeast Washington or related to current tribes. But new DNA studies in Europe by another scientist linked the bones most closely with Northwest tribes still here today.
How fast and changing science is. And it's just amazing today what science does and what people can do with science.
Educating outsiders why it's so culturally important for the tribes to rebury the skeleton has been hard. Minthorn sees little difference between Kennewick Man and the tribal elders he knows by name today. They all deserve respect in burial and in memory, he says.
This loss that we all go through when we lose an elder only inspires us to go on and go forward. Go on and go forward. Because each of us, whether we're Indian or non-Indian, we carry we do the best that we can to carry something with us from a relative, an elder, a friend that has passed on.
It's been a hard job speaking up for these remains for 20 years. But Minthorn says when that morning comes, when they bury Kennewick Man's bones, it won't be the last time he sees the Ancient One. All Minthorn's ancestors will be waiting when his own burial morning comes.
And those people are lined up. That land is all lit up. The land is making the most wonderful sound. And that gold light is making the most wonderful sound.
Minthorn believes everything you do in life is written and judged. The Ancient One is almost at rest. It's almost written. He's almost back to Earth. I'm Anna King in Mission, Oregon.
It's almost New Year's, a time for resolutions about what lays ahead of us, for reflections about what is behind us, and for a celebration of the threshold of the annual cycle of both the passing of one year and the arrival of another. People have been honoring the New Year for a long time. It hasn't always been done in exactly the same way or in the same manner, but many of the rituals around it are common to one another, and even the most exotic-seeming New Year's rituals will have at least something familiar in them. And yet, as universal as a tradition, as New Year's is, it's also something of a paradox, too. After all, so much of what we contemplate on New Year's doesn't actually exist at the moment of contemplation. The New Year's resolutions we make are set in future, and in so being, are about something that is not yet here. The New Year's reflections we have about the past are about the past, and as such, are about what is no more. And then there's the actual New Year's celebration. In and of itself, it's really rather empty, at least in comparison to other holidays. Yes, there's a nice party at the evening before, and perhaps a bit of a headache-induced solemnity and fortitude the day of, but so what? What is New Year's, then? What are we doing with it? And why do we care? Well, New Year's, I believe, is one of those occasions for taking stock in things that are always around us and yet just beyond our fingertips. In this case, it is a time for looking at the horizons of our lives, the things that we can see far off, before us and behind us, but cannot, in the present, grasp because they already were or are not yet. But so what? Why survey this greater terrain of our lives if it isn't really with us? What does making resolutions about losing weight or finishing that project or communicating with those we love better, what does all that do? Aren't we just going to frustrate ourselves with the inaccessibility of our grand plans and our lack of the wherewithal to realize them? And why contemplate the past? Why look at that limping old love affair that finally expired on Valentine's Day, or that clever little speech you gave at your friend's wedding last June? Isn't that just a recipe for longing or regret? I would say that if either of these endeavors, resolutions for the future or reflections upon the past, are done unskillfully, then yes, disappointments like those I've just mentioned are likely to ensue. The key word, though, is skillful. When all one does is gaze anxiously at the future or forlornly at the past, one is, rather ironically, displacing oneself from the present. It amounts to a kind of ruminating, and leaves you feeling displaced and disappointed in your life because it seems that everything worthy and beautiful in it is not presently there, even though it once was or is supposed to be. However, our resolutions and reflections don't need to be approached this way. They can be taken as a way of planting one's feet on the ground of now. One can look at the future and the resolutions we have towards it as an opportunity to focus our intentions here and now. It can be a way of rallying ourselves as we look towards the horizon of what might be in us, a bringing of the strength and fullness of ourselves to ourselves, all in the immediate step that is before us. It can, in other words, center us in our lives rather than displace us from them. One can look at the past and our reflections upon it as an accounting of sorts. It can be an opportunity to trace the path that leads to the now and see just what exactly makes the now, now. Whatever has been, no matter how dismal or splendid, no matter how mundane or extraordinary, is a stone in this road. Understanding and appreciating that is understanding and appreciating where you are now. Again, an opportunity for centering. And here then comes the third feature of New Year's, the celebration of this strange threshold of the coming and going years. Why celebrate it? We celebrate New Year's because it is a resting on the line between old and new. It invites us to center ourselves. The New Year's celebration is simply a way of drawing our attention to this opportunity and thereby making it a little more effective. And if we do find the celebration empty or insignificant, it is only because we choose to make it or leave it that way. So with the coming New Year's, take advantage of what it offers. None of us know what the future holds for us or will become of us. None of us can change the past or be the same in where we've been. But none of that matters ultimately. It doesn't matter because all of us have the power to be just where we are in the fullness of what we are. Perhaps this New Year's we can, by way of example, consider the thoughts of William Ellery Channing. To live content with small means, to seek elegance rather than luxury, and refinement rather than fashion, to be worthy, not respectable, and wealthy, not rich, to listen to stars and birds, babes and sages, with open heart, to study hard, to think quietly, act frankly, talk gently, await occasions, hurry never. In a word, to let the spiritual, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the common. This is my symphony. Perhaps this can be our symphony as well.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. And that's it for The Bridge. 2017 will see many changes here at Coast Community Radio, including changes in our public affairs programming. We'll still have the special voices and extended Northwest News features, but The Bridge won't be returning in the new year to make way for other programming. My thanks today to Northwest News correspondent Anna King and to Seth Titchener. The theme for The Bridge is A Place to Call Home, performed by the Sultans of String Symphony. It's available on Red River Records. Thank you for listening. I'm Kate Brister. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.